Sooner or later, you can bet your life that every Jew in this building is going to say the same thing. He's a little too Jewish for my taste.
Shalom and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Greg Schneider, the Executive Vice President of the Claims Conference, on the release of its new survey of British attitudes towards the Holocaust and anti-Semitism. We'll also have a visit from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. The opinions of the host and guests on Two Jewish are their own and not those of the radio station. Two Jewish is paid for by Two Jewish Radio Programs and Podcasts, Tucson, Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom, a brand new museum opened last week in Paris that has great importance for Jews and should have great importance for all people who live in free Western societies. It's the Museum of the Dreyfus Affair, which had an enormous impact on the development of modern Zionism and modern anti-Semitism. Nearly 130 years after it began, L'Affaire Dreyfus still teaches critical lessons about the perilous balance between civilization and barbarism that lurks in every seemingly civilized society. I suspect that most Americans don't know anything about the Dreyfus Affair, although any Jews with even a rudimentary knowledge of Zionism should. The story is set in the late 19th century, the 1890s, in fact, in France. This was an era often called La Belle Époque, the beautiful period, and it saw France, and especially Paris, host a glittering array of great artists, among them the Impressionists like Monet, Renoir, Toulouse-Lautrec, and Van Gogh, and equally fabulous writers and outstanding musicians of all kinds. The Paris Opera hosted what was considered to be the greatest artistic expressions of the entire era. Paris was the center of civilization. This was a time of rapid industrialization and spreading empire for the nations of the West, like Britain and France, a period that saw fantastic advances in technology and society that paralleled the cultural magnificence. Paris was, for the first time, truly the city of light. It had just received gas streetlights illuminating its grand new boulevards. It was a heady time to be alive. But it was also a time of great strain and apprehension in France. The Franco-Prussian War of the early 1870s had ended disastrously and quickly for France. A radical commune had taken over Paris in its aftermath, and an uneasy peace followed that collapse. France and Germany stared at each other across a border that was far from friendly, often seemingly on the knife edge of exploding into another major European war. Well, that didn't happen until 1914, and then, of course, again in 1939. But the underlying stress and downright hostility was a constant throughout that period. It was in this context that a French army captain named Alfred Dreyfus, a Jew from Alsace, a province that France had surrendered to the new German megastate after the Lost War, Dreyfus became the most polarizing figure in the whole Western world. Alfred Dreyfus was serving in Paris on the general staff of the military under an anti-Semitic commander in 1894, a torn-up note demonstrating that there was a spy within that general staff who was selling French army secrets to the German military attaché. Well, it was discovered in a trash bin. Dreyfus, a Jewish outsider in this military elite, was accused of being that spy. In less than 3 months, by January of 1895, Dreyfus was arrested, tried, convicted in a secret military court-martial, and publicly humiliated before being sent off to Devil's Island for a life sentence in that hellhole. Before a large crowd of jeering and often anti-Semitic spectators, Dreyfus cried out, "I swear that I am innocent. I remain worthy of serving in the army. Long live France! Long live the army!" In 1896, another French officer uncovered evidence that the true spy was not Dreyfus at all, but one of his supervisors, a Major Esterhazy. The courageous officer was immediately reassigned to Tunisia, and Esterhazy was acquitted of any charges. But the case was leaked to the press. A vigorous debate about anti-Semitism and civil rights began, and soon pro- and anti-Dreyfus societies sprang up all over France, then all over Britain, and even all over distant America. The Dreyfus case became the most famous court case of the 19th century, the most notorious abuse of justice in the world. Non-Jewish journalist Emile Zola published a famous letter that began, "J'accuse, I accuse." Accusing, well, he did, the military and the government of France of profound anti-Semitism and moral and fiscal corruption. Finally, Dreyfus was given a second trial. Esterhazy by that time had fled the country and confessed his espionage to a journalist in England. But poor Alfred was convicted again, in spite of all the evidence of his innocence, and sent back to Devil's Island. The entire conservative and Catholic hierarchy of France was against him. This time, the pressure on the leadership of France grew so intense that the president finally offered Dreyfus a full pardon in 1899. Although innocent of any crime, Dreyfus accepted that pardon rather than die on Devil's Island. Dreyfus was eventually restored to the army, promoted, and he served France nobly throughout the First World War. The impact of the Dreyfus affair was far-reaching, not least on a Viennese Jewish journalist covering the trials for his newspaper. Theodor Herzl heard the Paris mobs outside the courtroom crying, "Death to the Jews!" and realized that if that could happen in France, the very first nation on the planet to grant full civil rights to Jews as citizens, the most enlightened country on the planet at the time, well, it could happen anywhere. Jews would never truly be free or safe until we had our own nation with our own protection provided by our own military. Within a couple of years, Theodor Herzl organized the first Zionist Congress, which led ultimately to the founding of the State of Israel. Last week, French President Emmanuel Macron dedicated this new museum in northwest Paris to Dreyfus. Macron said nothing could repair the humiliations and injustices Dreyfus had suffered, and, quote, "let us not aggravate it by forgetting, deepening, or repeating them." That reference to not repeating follows attempts by the French far right to question Dreyfus's innocence a century and three decades after it all happened. An army colonel was cashiered back in 1994 for publishing an article suggesting Dreyfus was guilty. Far-right politician and avowed anti-Semite Jean-Marie Le Pen's lawyer responded back then that Dreyfus's exoneration was contrary to all known jurisprudence. And now, Eric Zemmour, a far-right political opponent of Macron, has said that France's Second World War Nazi collaborationist leader Marshal Philippe Pétain, who assisted in the deportation of French Jews to Nazi death camps, actually saved their lives. He said repeatedly in 2021, this year, that the truth about Dreyfus is not clear, his innocence not obvious. I hope this new Dreyfus Museum helps Parisians and French and more people of all nationalities to understand that if the most sophisticated and liberated population in the whole world could perpetrate a deeply anti-Semitic crime of this magnitude, every one of our societies has the capacity to do so even now. Unfortunately, anti-Semitism never quite seems to die. It should be obvious to us here in America, as the trial of neo-Nazis in Charlottesville winds down now, as Jews on campuses are attacked for supporting Israel, that we aren't so far from Dreyfus levels of anti-Semitic invective and action right here. On a happier note, the wonderful Festival of Lights, Hanukkah, is coming up fast, just 2 weeks from tonight. Play us in this morning for the upcoming holiday of latkes, dedication, and religious freedom. Here's Eli Goldstein's newish Hanukkah song, A Night of Light.
Some stories live, while others come and go. The greatest nations fell, but one stands alone. Doesn't matter who, when, why, doesn't matter how strong they are, it always ends the same. Oh, oh, oh. The world's getting lost as darkness takes hold. Can you be my light, a beacon of hope? Oh, oh, oh. Like years ago, you're not alone. So rise up and lead us. Tonight we're free. Tonight we won. Tonight we see that we're not alone. So raise our flag and spread your light. Tonight we dance, cause it's Hanukkah. Seem this few Maccabees picked up the torch, fought till they're free. Doesn't matter who, when, why, now when God's on your side, so spread out your wings for 8 days of flight. Flashbang away, evil will fade. 8 days of light will sing through the night. Oh, oh, oh. Like years.
That was A Night of Light, which starts sundown November 28th for 8 great nights. Join us for our fabulous Beit Simcha Celebrate 3 event on the 7th night of Hanukkah, Saturday, December 4th, in person. Go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org, and sign up for Celebrate 3. When we return on Two Jewish in a Moment, our guest, Greg Schneider, Executive Vice President of the Claims Conference, gives us the latest information on their newly released survey of Holocaust knowledge and attitudes in Great Britain, their perceptions of anti-Semitism there. There's good and bad news. Hear from him when we come back in a moment on Two Jewish.
We are the soul of Tucson. We are your neighbors and friends. Our commitment to provide the very best relies on the finest products and services you, our community, has to offer. Together, we make Tucson thrive. When we win, you win. Casino del Sol, the soul of Tucson.
Enterprise of the Pasquayaki Tribe.
Congregation Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a wonderful Jewish synagogue in northwest Tucson at Catalina Foothills. celebrates a great array of services, classes, and events this fall and winter. Established by passionate, caring congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha has created a vibrant, vital community that strives every day to serve God with joy. New Progressive Congregation in Northwest Tucson and the Foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everyone throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services Friday night and Saturday, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, cultural Jewish programming, and Jewish life cycles celebrations. Join us for in-person Shabbat services or come on Facebook Live. Go to our website, BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org. We welcome both members and guests to our sanctuary safely, but in person. Call 520-276-5675. That's 276-5675 for more information. Beit Simcha Synagogue is located at 2270 West Ina Road on the north side of Ina, just west of La Cholla, near the entrance to the Foothills Mall property in our own building. Services, classes, and events are open to everyone. Join us in person Friday night or Saturday morning or both. Email me, rabbi@beitsimchatucson.org. Or you can join us every Friday night on our Facebook page for Shabbat evening celebration services at 6:30 p.m., Shabbat morning services at 10 a.m., preceded by Torah study, all with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, leading them. Facebook page is Beit Simcha Tucson, BeitSimcha Tucson. Our services with full music, in person, but also by virtual experience. All of our Adult Education Academy classes, and there are plenty of them, are live and on Zoom. Access them at BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org. Our wonderful religious school is available in blended format too, some students live, some on Zoom. And don't forget our fabulous Hanukkah extravaganza, Celebrate 3, is coming up Saturday night, December 4th at 6:30 p.m. For more information about Congregation Beit Simcha, to come to services, our great religious school and Torah Tikes programs, bar and bat mitzvah, confirmation and high school programs, and rich array of adult education academy courses taught in person and on Zoom, and of course, all of our services on Facebook, go to BeitSimchaTucson.org or call 520-276-5675. Remember, you can come in person or online. 276-5675, BeitSimchaTucson.org. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, in the fastest growing and warmest Jewish community in all of Southern Arizona in its exciting beginning years. We are delighted to welcome to Jewish Greg Schneider. He is the Executive Vice President of the Claims Conference, an important organization that has worked for the rights of Holocaust survivors and now explores, in addition, knowledge of the Holocaust throughout the world. Good morning and welcome back to Too Jewish, Greg.
Good morning. Thanks for having me. Delighted to be here.
So there's a new survey. I hate to say each one comes out and it's always terrible, but there are some hopeful signs in this one. There's a new survey that Claims Conference has done on knowledge of the Holocaust in the United Kingdom. That is, of course, England, Scotland, Wales, Britain. Tell us the most interesting and the most recent findings.
So we are dividing the findings into four main areas. Number one, knowledge and awareness. Number two, knowledge around events about the UK during the Holocaust, neo-Nazism and anti-Semitism, and fourth, Holocaust education. I think, like most of the surveys that we've done, this is the fifth in a series of surveys that we've done, the first in the UK. Like most of them, it's disturbing. It certainly points to the fact that much more work needs to be done in the area of Holocaust education, but on the other hand, there are also hopeful and encouraging signs.
I think we have a couple minutes now, and then we'll cover it in much greater depth later in the show. Knowledge of the Holocaust, one hopeful if weird sign, people in the UK can identify concentration camp names, which Americans aren't very good at.
Yeah, so it was only about 32%, about one-third of UK respondents who could not name a single concentration camp or ghetto. And of course, there were over 40,000 of them. as opposed to the U.S., where in general for adults it was 45% that could not name one, and that went down to 48% in the U.S. for millennials and Gen Z. So in the U.K., they did score significantly better than in the U.S. on that one data point.
At least there's something good. Interest in knowledge of the Holocaust. In the UK, another positive finding, they largely seem to think that it should be taught in schools.
Yeah, this is consistent with what we've really saw in all of the surveys that we've done, US, Canada, Austria, and France, that 88% of adults in the UK felt that it was important that it be continued to be taught. Now, what's important to know is that it's compulsory in England, but that doesn't always mean that it's taught sufficiently, taught well, taught with compassion and passion, that a number of hours are devoted to the topic. So being invested in teaching is almost more important, or we think from all of the results we've seen across surveys, is much more important than it being compulsory.
We will talk much more with Greg Schneider of the Claims Conference about the UK Holocaust Knowledge and Awareness Survey and about anti-Semitism in the UK as well. When we come back in a moment here on Too Jewish.
Celebrate 3 is coming up fast. The best Hanukkah party in Southern Arizona features gourmet latkes, elegant appetizers, delicious drinks of all kinds, Hanukkah menorah lighting and songs, anniversary cake and desserts, dreidel gambling and games, elegant Hanukkah musical entertainment, a dedication, and much, much more. Join us Saturday night, December 4th for a fabulous celebration of 3 things. The 7th night of the Festival of Lights, Congregation Beit Simcha's 3rd anniversary celebration, the dedication of our new Bima, and food, fun, and frolic. Celebrate 3 is the best way to rejoice on Hanukkah this year. Go to BeitSimchaTucson.org to sign up for Celebrate 3 and make it a wonderful Hanukkah in person this year. That's Saturday night, December 4th at 6:30 p.m. at BeitSimchaTucson.org. Celebrate, consecrate, and dedicate food, drinks, candles, and fun at Celebrate 3.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, a kvetch or a kvel, please email us at TooJewishRadio18@gmail.com. That's TOOJewishRadio18@gmail, or visit our website at TooJewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, TooJewishRadio.com, streaming us from there, downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcasts, top 10 in America, according to Moment Magazine, over 100,000 downloads on Podbean. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
We started speaking last week about the Jewish communities of France, which are diverse because France is quite diverse. Let's start with one of them, and maybe the oldest of them. I tend to think that the Jews of southern France are among the oldest, but maybe you can clarify that.
Yeah, but even southern France has different regions,
right,
so it's not as simple
as
that. So first, I want to go back to one thing that I left out and shouldn't have last week, which is that one of the great efforts of the French state over many centuries has been to get all the people of France to speak a standardized version of the language. And one of the incredible differences in language was between the north and the south. In the south, there's still a region, although it's much smaller today than it was historically, called Languedoc, which means the language of Uck.
Like there's Languedoc and Languedoc or something.
Doi,
yeah.
So north of an imaginary line in France, people spoke the Languedoc, which I was their way of saying yes, which got transformed slowly into oui, which is what we all learn when we take French today, and that's standard French. In the south, however, in Occitanie, the way to say yes was Uck, and getting the southern half of France to say we or I instead of uck was a major objective of the French state for centuries. Also, still by way of introduction, and I know we're all eager to get to a specific community, and we will, I promise you, but there's a big French paradox between France as a motor of change for itself, for Europe, for the world, in terms of generating things like the Enlightenment, revolution, fashion, scientific innovation. France is a change agent, but at the same time, it is profoundly conservative in a way that is hard to overestimate. And I want to just give you one or two examples. I mean, one of the most striking things to me was I attended this fairly elite school in France called the National School of Administration that has a program whereby they admit a few lucky foreigners every year to learn about the glories and the splendors of French administration. And it's kind of funny because what you see are some of the cracks and some of the things they would rather keep hidden. But in that school, I learned from my peers, who were generally people in their 20s, that most people in France go into the same professions as their father and their grandfather. So if their father and grandfather was a notary public, they become notaries. If their father and grandfather was a pharmacist, they do that. And they're very conservative in that sense. Also, Charles de Gaulle once said, how can I be expected to govern a country that has 400 kinds of cheeses? So there's all these different cheeses. If you take the average French person, even if they really like to eat and drink, they've only tasted 4 or 5 of those 400 cheeses. Now, why is that? Well, you know me, I ask. And the answer I invariably got was, we eat the cheeses that we ate at our parents' table growing up, and our parents ate the cheeses they ate at their parents' tables growing up. So our family, for generations, has only eaten these 3 or 4 cheeses. And yeah, we're open to tasting other ones if you want to give us something, but we would never buy something other than what we're used to eating. And same with wines. As you know, France has many hundreds of different wines.
Many of them outstanding.
Same story. Yep. People drink the same 3, 4, 5 wines that they drank at their parents' table, and they are willing to taste others, but not
actually drink them regularly.
Right, exactly.
So the same thing must be true of the Jewish communities, I would assume, that there's a certain traditional quality to each of them that's unique in that way.
Right, and we will get to one of the most interesting ones, which does happen to be in the South, first thing next week.
Thanks, Tom. We'll talk then.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie new, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. This one comes from Gal Gadot, the Israeli actress, Wonder Woman, and model, and, well, funny gal. A baby, she says, is like instant coffee. Do you know why? It's easy to make, and it keeps you up all night. That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. This week's Sedra Vayishlach in Genesis continues the tale of Jacob, most intriguing of the patriarchs, a man who rises above his own duplicitous nature to become the father of almost all the tribes of Israel. As our story begins, Jacob is returning home to Canaan, having made good in the old country of Sumeria, Haran, in today's Turkey near the Syrian border. He has 4 wives, 12 children, including 11 sons, and large flocks of sheep and herds of cattle, truly great wealth. As he's about to cross into Canaan, he learns that his brother Esau, whom he wronged so seriously just before leaving home in a rush some 20 years before, is coming to meet him with an army of 400 men. Jacob panics, deducing that Esau's not headed his way with 400 guys with spears just to welcome him home. To try to preserve at least half of his household, Jacob divides his family and possessions into 2 camps, and then carefully arranges a large gift for Esau. That night he goes alone on a small island in the midst of a tributary of the Jordan River, the Yavok, to contemplate his options. While there, a stranger, called in Hebrew merely Ish, a guy, comes upon him.
The Torah is not clear as to whether this nocturnal visitor is man, angel, representative of God in some other way, even a character in a dream. Jacob wrestles with the visitor the rest of the night. Finally, as dawn is breaking, Jacob prevails. The stranger cannot break away, and before he can escape, Jacob insists the stranger give him a blessing. It is at that moment Jacob is blessed with a new name, Yisrael, Israel. First time that famous name is used in the Bible, or ever. It means either Prince of God, or more likely, the one who wrestles with God. And we children of Israel have been wrestling with God in one way or another ever since. As the angel tells Jacob, your name shall be called Israel, for you have contended with gods and men and have prevailed. Jacob survives, and the reunion with Esau proves to be anticlimactic. Esau comes up to Jacob with all his armed men, but instead of attacking him, he gives his brother a big hug and a kiss. And if all is not forgiven, at least no blood is shed. The dramatic narrative of Jacob's struggle and triumph has become a metaphor for our own struggles with belief and with family baggage. We are all descendants of Yisrael, the one who wrestles with God. And if we engage in that process for the sake of sacredness and belief, perhaps we too may triumph and reach our own promised land. Holiness can still be created and found. In fact, it's that very search and struggle that make us the people of Israel and give us a land engaged in that same pursuit. When we truly are children of the one who wrestled with God, Yisrael, when we choose to wrestle with God daily, we elevate our lives and our experience. May it be so in this coming holiday season and in all seasons. When we return on to Jewish, our guest, Greg Schneider, the Executive Vice President of the Claims Conference, fills us in on the latest findings on the Holocaust knowledge and attitudes in Great Britain. And there's both good news and sobering news. Find out both when we come back on Too Jewish in just a moment.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
A distressing report was released last week by Hebrew Union College, the Jewish Institute of Religion, the Reform Movement Seminary, and one of my own alma maters. The law firm hired to investigate allegations and demonstrated acts of abusive and improper conduct stated that a long pattern of terrible behavior and a climate of abuse of women students and faculty existed at all the movement's four campuses over a period of many years. Six prominent figures were named in the report, including former chancellors Alfred Gottschalk and Sheldon Zimmerman, as well as four other well-known and once-respected faculty members, with abuses spread across Cincinnati, New York, Los Angeles, and the Jerusalem campuses of HUC-JIR. Interestingly, four of the six men named in the report are dead now. The other two are no longer employed at the seminary and have been the subject of public exposure for some time. No current faculty were named in the report, which seems surprising in view of the recency of some of the allegations. The offenses committed to the College Institute included both professors having improper sexual relations with students, as well as a variety of sexual harassment and other abusive actions, all conducted over many years. The administration of HUCJIR was aware of some of the conduct and at times did little to address it or prevent it from being perpetuated. Many of the actions detailed in the report are truly reprehensible. I cannot personally speak to the results it uncovered, except to note that while I found the Jerusalem and Los Angeles campuses of HUC to be a little idiosyncratic, and there were one or two abusive faculty members in a kind of colloquial sense, in general, they were pretty good places to study and be a rabbinic student overall. On the other hand, the Cincinnati campus, in spite of having a couple of kind and generous professors, was one of the weirdest and creepiest places I have ever encountered.
I didn't know about the sexual abuse taking place, although there were rumors about certain professors and administrators. But the general attitude towards rabbinic students, who are graduate students of various ages and not fresh out of high school youths or something, was shockingly degrading and sometimes downright exploitative. This report is bad, but I wonder if it is actually covering up some things, too. There is also a law firm the Central Conference of American Rabbis has hired to investigate conduct in that organization, the Rabbinic Organization of the Reform Movement, which is also investigating the Union for Reform Judaism, the umbrella organization of the congregations of the Reform Movement. This story has a long way to go yet. I suspect the findings will not be pretty. A French court sentenced a man to life in prison for what it termed the anti-Semitic murder of a Holocaust survivor in Paris in 2018. The murderer of Morel Knoll, Yassine Milhoub, will be eligible for parole in just 22 years, according to the ruling of the Criminal Tribunal of Paris. An accomplice of his, Alex Karambakis, was sentenced to 15 years for theft, aggravated by a hate crime for their actions in 2018. The charred body of Morel Knoll, 85 years old, was discovered in her apartment March 23, 2018. Knoll, who escaped deportation to a Nazi death camp when French police rounded up the Jews of Paris in 1942, was stabbed 11 times before her apartment was set ablaze by the perpetrators. Mihoub, 29 years old, is a son of Knoll's neighbor, had known her his whole life. He and Karambakis, 23 years old, were indicted in May 2020. In the French verdict, the two men's crimes were found to have been anti-Semitic because they targeted Knoll out of the belief that robbing and killing her would be lucrative because she is Jewish. Knoll's murder provoked an outcry by French Jews, including a protest march through Paris organized by Jewish community leaders in which 10,000 people participated. Knoll's murder occurred about a year after the slaying of Sarah Halimi, a Jewish physician, by a neighbor who shouted about Allah as he murdered her. The killer in that case, Kobili Traor, did not stand trial because a judge found he was suffering a psychotic episode induced by the consumption of marijuana. That ruling, which ended with Traor being admitted to a psychiatric institution, sparked a wave of protests by French Jews and their allies. Knoll's family said they deemed the sentences imposed on her murderer and robber to be fair. Paul Rudd, the Jewish movie star whose original family name was Rudnitsky, was named People's Magazine's Sexiest Man Alive in 2021. He responded to the magazine with his signature sense of humility that has helped endear him to fans, in addition to his good looks, for over two decades of mostly comedic roles. "When I think of myself, I think of myself as a husband and a father," he said. "I just hang out with my family when I'm not working. That's what I kind of like the most. There are so many people that should get this before me," he added. He also mentioned that his wife giggled when she heard about it. Rudd, who is 52 years old, was born to English Jewish parents. He learned about the anti-Semitism his ancestors faced during the PBS genealogy series Finding Your Roots back in 2017. Rudd said he grew up largely detached from religion, but experienced some anti-Semitism himself as a kid growing up in Missouri and Kansas. Before he made a name for himself in blockbuster comedies like Clueless, Anchorman, and Knocked Up, Rudd was briefly a bar and bat mitzvah DJ. Rudd has played a few Jewish roles, notably the former catcher in war spy Mo Berg in a feature film. His next big role is a very Jewish one. He will star as Dr. Ike Hirschkoff in the Apple Plus TV adaptation of The Shrink Next Door, a 2019 podcast about a Jewish psychiatrist plugged into the New York Jewish community who takes over the life of one of his Jewish patients. The list of famous Jews formerly named Sexiest Man Alive is short, like Jews. Pop star Adam Levine was given the honor in 2013, while actor Harrison Ford, who had a Jewish mother and partly defines himself as Jewish, was given the title in 1998. English soccer legend David Beckham, whose maternal grandmother was Jewish and has called himself half-Jewish, was People Magazine's choice in 2015. David Beckham sent his youngest son, Cruz, to a Jewish preschool in L.A. attached to Stephen S. Wise Temple. Rudd also has said about this, "I'm going to embrace this. I'm having business cards made." And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews Round the World. My brothers,
Celebrate 3 is coming up fast. The best Hanukkah party in southern Arizona features gourmet latkes, elegant appetizers, delicious drinks of all kinds, Hanukkah menorah lighting and songs, anniversary cake and desserts, dreidel gambling and games, elegant Hanukkah musical entertainment, a dedication, and much, much more. Join us Saturday night, December 4th for a fabulous celebration of three things. The seventh night of the Festival of Lights, Congregation Beit Simcha's third anniversary celebration, the dedication of our new Bima, and food, fun, and frolic. Celebrate 3 is the best way to rejoice on Hanukkah this year. Go to BeitSimchaTucson.org to sign up for Celebrate 3 and make it a wonderful Hanukkah in person this year. That's Saturday night, December 4th at 6:30 p.m. at BeitSimchaTucson.org. Celebrate, consecrate, and dedicate food, drinks, candles, and fun at Celebrate 3.
We welcome back to Two Jewish, I would say a semi-frequent guest, Greg, at this point. The Executive Vice President of the Claims Conference, Greg Schneider, on the new release of their survey, UK Holocaust Knowledge and Awareness, which is has some not surprising, but also some eye-opening findings to share. What was the biggest surprise in this survey, do you think?
I'm not sure it's the most important finding all across, but I think the most surprising thing for me was the lack of awareness about the Kinder transport.
Right.
So I hope most of your listeners know about the Kinder transport, which was an effort to bring children, mostly from Germany and Austria, German-speaking countries, to the UK. And what we were surprised to find, it was a real heroic effort of England at the time, particularly given how few countries were taking refugees. But the fact is that most people didn't know about their own country's history. It was really quite shocking. I think so many Jews know about Kinder transport, or people who are certainly connected with Shoah have heard about Kinder transport. Most people had no idea what it was.
Yeah, I mean, it's extraordinary because those children, most of them ended up in Britain during the war.
Yeah, they were all during the war. They were all brought to Britain. Yeah, and then they lived. They were dispersed to different families, mostly non-Jewish, as a matter of fact, families throughout throughout Britain. Now, after the war and the subsequent decades, many have moved to the United States. They moved to Israel, but about half of them continue to live their whole lives in the UK.
Now, I actually, unfortunately, don't share your optimism that most Jews know about the Kinder transport in the United States. I wish it did. I think if you surveyed it, it wouldn't be the case, but it was a remarkable effort to save the children. Parents putting their kids on this transport, I mean, it's really kind of stunning to think about, so that they would survive while the parents most likely perished in the camps.
So maybe I misspoke a little bit. Maybe I really meant to say, because I'm such a frequent flyer with you and your podcast,
right?
I'm not getting a true representation of the Jewish world, but maybe of your listeners.
There you go.
I would think most would know Kinder transport. But anyway, in the UK, 76% of the respondents had no idea what Kinder transport was, which really, that was one of the most shocking findings. 89% of respondents said they had definitely heard about the Holocaust. So that's fantastic, right?
Right.
The problem is, and again,
89% is everybody, to be honest, right?
Yeah. The problem is, when you dig deeper, what does that really mean? So having a vague sense of the Holocaust is not really tremendously important. And I do want to underscore for the listeners is that any particular data points, because, for instance, we asked, how many people could name a specific camp or ghetto? How many people knew that 6 million Jews were killed in the Holocaust? And you see pretty terrible results across the board. Maybe not as bad as the United States in some cases, but really not very encouraging. But again, it's not about, for us, it's really not about any specific data point. Ultimately, the point about Holocaust education is to really understand the concept of genocide, what happened to the Jewish people, how is it that it happened in these societies, that it went on for years, and what does that say about our place in society today and our responsibility? It really has to encourage critical thinking about human rights and minorities, anti-Semitism, Jews, etc. So any one of these particular data points not so critical, I think. But when you look at it as a whole, it really suggests a lot more work needs to be done.
You know, I was taken, in fact, by, as you mentioned, a data point, but a fact that many people in the UK thought their government had done a great deal to try to stop the Holocaust. Well, of course, they eventually, Nazi Germany was defeated, but that they'd allowed immigration of Jews before and during the war. Not really true. I think the same thing would be true in America. People would think the U.S. government did more than it actually did. And that becomes crucial when there are Holocausts going on in the world, when there are genocides, maybe not the Shoah, but terrible things happening, and we close our borders. Just a really important point, I think.
So I don't really want to opine on refugee policy in general.
Sure.
I do often hear that survivors talk about the fact that they went through very difficult, traumatic, but legal process to come to the United States. And that was very important to them. I'm certainly grateful that the United States gave them safety and safe harbor and opportunity that so many other countries didn't. But your general point about citizens believing that their own countries are far more magnanimous than they really are,
right,
or did much more, it is a data point in all three of the survey.
U.S., Canada, and the U.K., right?
Yeah, so in Canada, we probably had the most restrictive immigration policies. Remember the famous line, none or too many, you know, zero is too many.
Right, not zero is too many, right.
Yeah, and yet the perception was that the country, that their country had in fact let in refugees, and the exact same thing in England, that the general perception was that during the war, there were open door policies welcoming Jews into their countries. And of course, that's not the case at all. Absolutely not.
The Claims Conference has transformed sort of its work in many ways. With this important survey, where do you think the next survey is going to be? Or do you see this as a continuing part of the central mission of the Claims Conference?
Okay, so let me take the. I'm open to suggestions on the first question. Where should we look next? We get a lot of unsolicited advice,
sure.
But now I'm actually soliciting. So interested to hear people's opinions.
Please.
On the second question about our mission, I want to be clear. Our central focus today and for the past 70 years, because we're actually just this month celebrating or acknowledging our 70th anniversary.
Right, the 70th anniversary of the Claims Conference, correct?
Yeah,
the Claims Conference. Mazel tov, by the way, actually.
Yeah, thanks. Has been, and always will be, as long as there are survivors alive, care and welfare for Holocaust survivors. So just to put it in context, we are distributing pensions and one-time payments to over 260,000 Holocaust survivors around the world, and it's in excess this year of about $650 million. And we're also providing home care, food, and medicine, which is also around $680 million this year. So that's clearly the focus and will continue to be as long as there's one survivor alive. You know, they should all live to 120. However, overwhelmingly, as we speak to survivors, which we do every day, they're concerned with their legacy. They're concerned with memory and ensuring that the lessons will outlive them because they're realists. And we're at a crunch time. We're at an inflection point where we are losing our last witnesses, and the transformation, the evolution from witness testimony to history is happening before our eyes. And we have to evolve, certainly the Claims Conference and society, to cope with that. And part of the importance of the surveys for us is to draw more attention to this notion of Holocaust education, its benefits, why it's important, which thank God in all the surveys people recognize and want it to be taught in schools. But what's happening in the schools and where kids are learning is not aligning with what people are saying is the most important thing, which is that, you know, people understand the lesson. So we will continue. The answer to your question is the evolving mission, the emerging and evolving mission of Holocaust education, very important to the Claims Conference, and will continue. We'll probably do another survey. And, you know, it gets more interesting as time goes on because as the comparison among countries really fascinating. And then at some point, there's also longitudinal studies. So if these were the results, you know, 5 years ago, what are they going to be in another 5 years and see how things have changed from you know, over certain periods of time. But if you have any suggestions of what should be the next country, We're open to it.
Well, it depends. Does it have to be an English-speaking country? That's the question.
Definitely not. We've, as you know, we've done France and Austria.
Right.
Those are two of the five countries we've done. People have suggested we should look at some countries in Eastern Europe.
I think that would be interesting. I'd be very interested in what's happening in Germany, personally. I think it's a crucial country right now, and so many Jews have moved there. People aren't aware of the growing Jewish. It's one of the few countries in Europe, maybe the only country, with a growing Jewish population. My personal vote would be for Germany right now.
So fascinating. Germany does have a growing Jewish population. There was a time when there was significant influx from the former Soviet Union.
Right.
So you have sort of the old-timer German Jewish, you know, post-Holocaust population.
The people that came back or stayed, right?
Yeah, the people who stayed. You have people, as I said, people who came from Russia, and now you have Israelis.
Right.
And there's a significant Israeli population. So it's complicated and it's diverse. It's not unified. So that's sort of on the Jewish side. On the non-Jewish side, as I said, there really is a difference between, even though, you know, unified Germany has existed now for 30 years, you would think it's a whole generation. You would think it would make, obviously, it's a significant difference, but there really is a divide.
Between East Germany and West Germany still.
Particularly
yeah.
on our issues, yeah, on the territories of East Germany and West Germany. Yep. So what you see in Frankfurt is very different than what you would see, you know, in Leipzig.
Yeah, absolutely. I just think it would be fascinating. I want to thank Greg Schneider for a great visit here on Too Jewish. Where can people go to find out about this survey and more about the Claims Conference?
So the best place is our website, which is www.claimscon.org. You'll find everything there about the survey and the Claims Conference in general. Thanks for having me again.
Thank you again. When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest and get a final musical play out.
We are the soul of Tucson. We are your neighbors and friends. Our commitment to provide the very best relies on the finest products and services you, our community, has to offer. Together, we make Tucson thrive. When we win, you win. Casino del Sol, the soul of Tucson. Enterprise of the Pasquayaki Tribe.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next week. Our guest will be Rabbi Jack Romberg, author of the new book, A Doorway to Heroism, a decorated German Jewish soldier who became an American hero. It's the tale of his great uncle, Richard Stern, a German soldier in World War I, a resistor in Cologne at the start of Hitler's reign, and the Silver Star-decorated U.S. soldier in World War II. Good story. Don't miss it. And don't forget, join us at Congregation Beit Simcha in person every Friday night for services in Oneg Shabbat, all starting at 6:30 p.m. Saturday morning, too, 9 a.m. Torah study, 10 a.m. services and Torah reading in Kiddush, or come to our Facebook page and watch it online. Our playout this morning comes from Adam Sandler, and it's his version 2 of his Hanukkah song. Sign up now for Celebrate 3, the fabulous Hanukkah Festival, celebrating the third anniversary of my own congregation, Beit Simcha, Saturday night, December 4th, 6:30 p.m. Food, drink, music, lights, latkes, menorahs, dreidels, silent auction, prizes, games, and much, much more. Go to BeitSimchaTucson.org to sign up now for Celebrate 3. My friends, may you have a healthy week. God willing, a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week we pray of peace.
Put on your yarmulke, it's time for Hanukkah. So much Hanukkah to celebrate Hanukkah. Hanukkah is festival of lights. Instead of one day of presents, we get 8 crazy nights. But when you feel like the only kid in town without a Christmas tree, here's a new list of people who are Jewish. Just like you and me. Winona Ryder drinks Manischewitz wine, then spins a dreidel with Ralph Lauren and Calvin Klein. Guess who gives and receives loads of Hanukkah toys?
Sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.